Growth occurs in cycles, whether it's in the brain or in what we do or what we feel. Growth occurs through processes that repeat and build, creating the complex skill, the complex feelings that we know as human adults. And that's the topic for today, how the growth cycles occur. To the best of our knowledge today, we're going to focus on growth cycles in the construction of the cortex, growth cycles in the development of cortical activity, in the construction of skill, and we're going to generally talk about how we assess brain activity and anatomy through brain imaging techniques, and how those findings from those techniques relate to how skills develop and emotions develop. So in general, we're going to have a focus on cycles, and we're going to end up with an explanation of a model of how cycles of growth are nested inside each other to create the kind of complex human behavior that we all have. There's a misconception we have to start off being rid of, and that is the kind of prevalent misconception in the United States, in English language cultures more generally, that we are brains, that we learn with our brains, as opposed to being people who have brains that help us learn. We're not brains disembodied in a bucket sitting in the corner. And likewise, we don't learn by having information stuck into our brains. So by one image, see, I have a port up here on my brain, you see that little mark on the forehead, and that's where I plug in every morning and the computer tells me the knowledge for today. Well, it doesn't work that way. We have to learn more actively than that. So it's not true that you can plug the world into the brain and thereby know everything. Instead, knowledge has to be built. And likewise, brain structure has to be built. These growth cycles we're talking about today are about how the brain structure and the knowledge are built. The cortex is a remarkable structure with multiple layers of neurons connected to each other. It shows a recurring growth pattern that produces a hierarchical organization. Likewise, in skill, we have a hierarchical organization created by a recurring growth cycle. And likewise, in cortical activity, there's such a cycle. So we're going to talk about those, all three of them today. Starting off with the cortex. The cortex is organized into six columns of neurons. And they're numbered from the top down because that was the way they were discovered as people went into the brain and looked at it. So the first layer, so-called, is on the top. Actually, in development, that's the last layer to develop. The way this is constructed developmentally was discovered by Pasco Rakic and other neuroscientists. It's a wonderful process, a growth cycle producing layered cortex. If you look at the diagram, you see there's a glial cell that makes a kind of a ladder. And there is at the bottom of the cortex a layer of germ cells. The germ cells are creating new neurons. The neurons are climbing up the ladder, the scaffold, and jumping off to form a layer. So the first layer the first one to grow is the sixth layer. That forms first. And then once that's formed, the next bunch of neurons climb a little further up the glial cell ladder, and they jump off at the next layer, making layer five. Eventually they jump off a little bit higher still, and they make layer four, and then they jump off a little bit higher still, making layer three, then layer two, and finally layer one. So in this way, through this repetitive growth cycle, the neurons in the germ cells form six layers of the cortex, with the last layer, the highest layer, performing higher cognitive functions from what we know about it, and the lower layers performing more basic functions for perception, for motor action, for body control. So in general, this cyclical process occurs in formation of the cortex, and we think cycles like this occur throughout the brain going on into adulthood. We're still trying to discover what they are. One of the most exciting achievements of the last decade or even 20 years has been discovering just how much plasticity, how much growth there is going on in the brain, even of adults. So it used to be thought that that a whole bunch of things about the brain were set very early on, that the number of neurons, the number of synapses, and a lot of other properties were fixed, and that those could not be changed in adults. That all that happened was that we would lose some brain cells. It was believed because of brain damage from toxins or drinking too much or not getting enough sleep or getting hit on the head. We have a very different view now. We know that the brain is constantly renewing itself in every way that we've been able to look at, and that there are wonderfully complicated processes that go on in brain growth. There are dendrites that form. That was maybe the first thing that we knew. Neurons form dendrites, little tree structures that connect with other neurons, and myelin, a kind of insulation around the neuron forms. It was thought that we didn't grow new neurons or new synapses, and then over the last decade there have been discoveries of new synapses forming in adult, even in old adult rats, most recently, just in a couple of years, the last couple of years, new neurons have been found to be forming in the cortex, even in monkeys, with hints of it in people. Other growth processes that are going on that we've discovered are the pruning of neurons and dendrites and synapses, the kind of cleaning away of ones that aren't functioning well, that aren't needed, and the formation of neural networks. We'll focus today especially on the formation of neural networks, but that depends on all these other processes of synapses and new neurons growing and pruning away dysfunctional or not necessary connections. So contrary to the classic neuroscience dogma that the brain was fixed shortly after birth, it turns out that the brain is just as plastic as we psychologists thought, with our evidence for enormous plasticity in learning and development. One of the most exciting studies in this area was done by Elizabeth Gould just recently, published in Science in 99, where she found that new neurons growing in rhesus monkey migrating up into the cortex, especially the prefrontal, temporal, and parietal cortex, not so much the sensory cortex. So the areas where we think that there's a lot of learning going on, those are the areas where she was finding the neurons moving to, the new neurons moving into. Very exciting study. Still somewhat controversial because it challenges the dogma of decades in neuroscience. But there's so much evidence now for new neurons growing in all kinds of animals that it's almost certainly true. In cognitive development, there are cycles that occur that we see in growth curves for skill. We have cycles of reflected in spurts or other kinds of discontinuities where skills jump forward at a certain point in development. We'll see as we progress today, similar growth patterns occur for brain activity, cortical activity, as measured by the electroencephalogram, or EEG. In cognitive development, we have to distinguish between optimal level and functional level. That's the best somebody can do when they're highly supported versus their kind of ordinary performance. And it's the best, the optimal level, that really relates most closely to brain functioning and that shows the clearest growth cycles. You'll see, as we've already hinted at in earlier things in the course, that stages, as evidenced in what people can do in their skills, in their emotions, stages come and go. They appear and disappear depending upon what you're looking at. They are very clearly present when you look at optimal level, supported, high-level functioning, as you can see on the graph with the jumps in optimal level. And they don't generally appear nearly as clearly, or even not at all, in ordinary performance and functional level. So stages are not either present or not present. They're both present and not present, depending upon what aspect of behavior you look at. We've talked about developmental webs as the kind of essential structure for skill development and emotional development. When you look at the web, there are clusters of discontinuities across strands in the web. So development is occurring in independent strands with just weak links between them. But even though they're mostly independent, there are parallel developments that occur indicating stage-like change. As you can see in the diagram, in the concurrent zone where the different strands divide or come together or change direction or speed up in their development. So in general, when we look at cognitive development, there are cycles of skill development that form levels and tiers. These clusters of discontinuities that we were just talking about demonstrate or reflect the emergence of a new level. The levels are kind of grouped together into tiers. There's strong evidence for these levels in infant development from brain activity research and from cognitive research. And likewise, through childhood and adolescence into early adulthood, there's very good evidence for spurts at certain ages in certain domains, indicating the emergence of a new level, which traditionally has been called a stage. We're going to review some of this evidence for both skill and for brain activity, and we're going to present the neural network growth hypothesis as a way of kind of bringing it all together. So, reflective judgment, this will be our main behavioral example today. Reflective judgment is a process that John Dewey originally described, where we look upon our own knowledge or other people's knowledge and try to reflect upon it to determine how we know something is true or how we know something is not true. Karen Kitchener and Patricia King have done a lot of research on how this understanding develops. It's much more likely to develop in people who are in a cultural setting where there are different viewpoints and different conclusions. There isn't consensus about everything. And an area where in our society as we experience it, there are such arguments is one of their dilemmas, chemical additives. Chemical additives are put in food all the time, and there are arguments about whether the additives are healthful or harmful. Do they prevent illness, like keeping you from dying of food poisoning or getting extremely sick from food poisoning, or do they cause cancer or other kinds of illnesses? in the dilemma, this dilemma and several other dilemmas like this, Kitchener and King have studied people's reasoning about knowledge, and they found the 7 clear-cut stages emerging from age 2 to about age 30 under optimal conditions. For those of you that are interested in moral development, Kohlberg being the most famous developmentalist in that area, these stages are a lot like Kohlberg's moral stages, but they're a little bit more differentiated, a little bit more explicitly defined, and better tied down empirically. I'm just going to illustrate one growth function for one of the stages of reflective judgment, which shows you this difference between optimal and functional level. The sixth stage of reflective judgment is common in adults beyond their early 20s in universities. It is something that is close to the kind of most sophisticated reasoning that Dewey talked about and labeled reflective judgment. The basic argument is something like that although knowledge is uncertain, so we can't really know if something is true or false absolutely for sure forever, we can come to pretty strong, well-justified conclusions where we say something is true, at least for what we know now, and it depends on our looking at viewpoints, evidence, and argument in order to come to that conclusion. So we have to be able to reason about different evidence, different arguments about that evidence, different viewpoints toward that evidence, put them all together in order to conclude what's the most sensible conclusion for the evidence that we have now. And in the study that Kitchener and I and our collaborators did, developed a way of assessing optimal level for reflective judgment by presenting a prototypic answer, a good answer based on the hundreds of people that had been interviewed before for each of the stages, for each of the dilemmas. We present that to a person and then ask them to explain that prototype to us. So an example of a high support assessment is that you present a good argument and then you ask the people to explain it in their own terms. So all of the key parts are primed, they're in front of the person. If the person is capable of understanding the argument and making the argument, they will do it with the help of the priming, and their optimal level will be at stage 6. If they cannot do it even with the priming, then they will not demonstrate stage 6. They will be at an earlier stage in their argument. Here's a graph of the results of this study with students from 14 to 28 years of age in Denver, Colorado. If you look at ordinary performance, what they do in a standard interview without the support of the high structure assessment, prototype, you see low levels of performance into the early 20s, rising up to about 40% correct in the mid and late 20s with a sort of standard general S-shaped growth curve. But if you look at optimal performance with the prototypes that I mentioned, you see instead a series of jumps. Even though this is stage 6 performance as measured by the scale that Kitchener and King devised, the emergence of stage 6 leads to performance only at about 50%. So there's a spurt at around 20 years of age up to about 50% correct. And then 5 years later, when the next stage is emerging, the performance jumps up to 100% correct, or nearly 100% correct. This is typical of knowledge development, that when a skill first emerges for an optimal level, there's a spurt in performance, but not to perfect performance, to really master an understanding at stage 6 or whatever the specific stage is. You need to be beyond it. You need to be on at stage 7 in order to fully understand stage six. From the arithmetic examples that that you've been reading about, if you really understand addition, it helps a lot to be able to relate addition to subtraction, addition to multiplication. It gives you a better understanding of what addition is. This is a general process that you have a spurt when a new level emerges, but you also have further jump when the next level emerges, even for the skills at the earlier level. In the graph, you'll see there's even a hint of a spurt for the prior level at about 16 years of age, but of course it's not statistically reliable because there's just a few students that showed it. In general, understanding these growth curves, understanding the processes behind development, the growth processes that produce these recurring cycles of change, is greatly facilitated by the advent of constructive dynamics, of tools for building explicit models of what growth processes are and relating them to the change that we actually see. This gentleman is pointing at a blackboard where there's a complicated growth curve that when I was in graduate school, people would dismiss as growth doesn't look like that. It's supposed to be smooth. But now we understand that growth is commonly complicated, and we understand that we can build explicit mathematical models to show us some of the reasons that it's complicated. So the kind of growth curves that we're talking about here can be modeled expressly in this new kind of theory in psychology, explicit mathematical nonlinear dynamic models of change, of growth. All of these models involve iterations over time. One of the basic properties of development is that who I am tomorrow is based on who I am today. Likewise for learning, one of the basic processes of learning is what I know tomorrow is based on what I know today and what I learned in between. So all of these models involve this iteration process, as you can see with the arrow showing iteration. And as it happens, with the great tools we now have with computers and computer programs, you can build models of growth, models of learning, models of development with your spreadsheet program that you have on your computer. You can use Excel or any of the spreadsheet programs. They are designed to be able to look at changes like mortgage payments, but mortgage payments have a lot in common with growth in that in mortgage payments, just like with growth, tomorrow's payment is predicted by today's. So it's actually quite exciting. We can all go home, go to our Excel spreadsheet program, and start building models for how we think growth occurs, how we think learning occurs, and then see whether the growth that is obtained actually shows the properties that we think it's supposed to from those theories of growth processes. One of the most important shapes in development that we didn't really know about 20 years ago is this curve that shows spurts with perhaps mild drops after the spurts. It's a series of spurts in a hierarchy. We've built models of that. I'm just going to briefly touch on them. It's called logistic growth because it's based on a log function. And it's hierarchical, meaning that later skills are built on earlier skills, and a whole bunch of different pieces are interconnected to each other. And that tends to produce this kind of growth. I'm just going to show you the kind of growth that we got from a model of skill development, and you'll see how close the model's curves come to the kind of growth curve that we saw for reflective judgment. And later, you'll see the same thing for brain activity. So here we have five different skills that are growing, and you see all of them show a series of fits and starts. based on this growth model. If you use the terms of nonlinear dynamics, each of the times that the growers are all kind of coming toward each other is an attractor level. And there are a series of five of those. Those are the things that we call levels or stages in the study of development. They're called attractors in nonlinear dynamics. You'll also notice that that there's a drop-off after every jump. Or not every jump, but most jumps. Many times there's actually a negative growth after a jump. And this seems to be a very general process. Even in head growth, some years ago, when people measured babies' heads growing and they thought that the brain was getting slightly smaller, or the head was getting slightly smaller, they thought they were just measuring wrong. But now we think that probably actually does occur that the you know, the after a jump in size, there's a slight shrinkage. And we certainly know that's true for skills. So when we look at data and the growth models, we find that the best model we have right now for describing skill development is that there are 13 of these periods of spurts with the emergence of a new optimal level between birth and 30 years of age, and that they're grouped into four tiers with three or four levels in each tier. I'll just show you a couple of diagrams to illustrate the levels and tiers to kind of help out with the conceptualization. So there are four tiers. Each one is a different kind of mental or cognitive unit. We start off with reflexes. We then move on to actions or sensory motor intelligence. We then move to representations in early childhood. The first two are from infancy. And finally, we move on to abstractions in adolescence and adulthood. Each of those is a different kind of mental unit. Each of them emerges at a particular time through a series of levels culminating in the construction of one of these new skill units. If we want to show how it occurs within each tier, you can actually see the cycles of development. You start off with a single structure. You see that little blue dot up there. And then that becomes a mapping. Here we're doing it for representations. Then the mapping becomes a system, which here is shown as a square. Then the square mapping becomes, square system becomes a system of systems, which is a new unit. You see it forms a cube now, and the cube goes on to begin another tier, another cycle, which then moves to form a mapping, a system, and a system of systems, again a new unit, which then goes on to form potentially yet another tier. So for each tier, we have a series of levels that form a growth cycle that repeats itself and that creates a new unit, allowing further development. If we do it just one more way diagrammatically, you can see all four units cycling. First, reflexes in the first few months of life, then sensory motor actions between like 3 months and 2 years. Then representations between about 2 years and 12 years, and then abstractions emerging at about 10 or 12 and moving on into adulthood. Now, how do these relate to brain development? The best evidence at this point is that they're nicely linked with brain activity changes. We have a lot of research to do to really pin it all down, but there's a model of how they connect to each other, which is quite specific, and a few tests of it, which are encouraging that it actually might hold in its general form and many of its specifics. The main evidence we're going to talk about today is brain activity, in particular the electroencephalogram, electrical activity in the cortex as measured by electrodes put on the head. The brain waves generally look about like that. They're complicated waves, as you can see. They have a lot of interesting properties. You can measure a bunch of those properties. It turns out that several of those properties show strong development, and that development looks a lot like the kind of patterns of skill development that we've just seen. Gary Larson liked to play with dinosaurs. Here he has dinosaurs sitting down for their weekly brainstem storming sessions. Happily for us, we are mammals, not reptiles, and we have a complex, very convoluted cortex, and we're really talking about the cortex, not the brainstem here. So the measures we're talking about are cortical, not the lower brain systems. There are a lot of brain imaging techniques. There's been a remarkable surge in brain imaging techniques, especially in the last 10 years, but really over the last 50 years. I've listed the main ones here. The electroencephalogram is the one I just showed you. The magnetoencephalogram is the same thing, or very similar, but it's the magnetic waves rather than the electrical waves from the cortex. The event-related potential is a measure taken from the EEG or the MEG to measure the brain's response to a particular event. Then there are other measures which look at anatomy and blood flow. The classic one has been positron emission tomography, or PET. Since that uses radioactive materials, it's dangerous and can't be used very generally. But the newer technique called MRI, that you're learning a lot about in this course, hopefully, creating a lot of new evidence about how the brain works and how the brain's anatomy is formed. You can actually look at living brains. You don't have to wait for somebody to die in order to look at their brain. You can look at the anatomy of the brain, so you see how it's shaped and what the relative sizes of different places are. You can look at blood flow. You can look at water flow. There's a film that we're asking you to look at that was made specifically for this course through Mind, Brain, and Behavior on fMRI, and that's available on the web. It gives you a lot of good, helpful information and examples of how fMRI works, functional magnetic resonance imaging. I have to tell this story. When phenomenon behind MRI was first discovered, there was a Nobel Prize for it. One of the people who got the prize was a Harvard professor named Purcell. And in his acceptance speech in Scandinavia, he said that this was an obscure technique that would never have any practical significance. Well, it took a long time. It took about 40 or 50 years for people to turn it into a practical technique, but it obviously has great practical significance, as seen now by the revolutions that it's causing in medicine and in neuroscience. This is a graph that illustrates most of the main brain imaging techniques and how they measure brain activity relative to time and to extent of location. So on the horizontal axis, you have time from milliseconds to hours. On the vertical axis, you have range from a single neuron to a wide region of the brain. The different techniques have very different strengths. So you'll see, for example, EEG and MEG and ERP are great at high-speed change. But they can't look at a really small region. It has to be a relatively large region, you know, like maybe the size of a nickel or a quarter at least. Some other techniques, like looking at a single cell, you can actually get a wide range of time parameters from very fast change to slower change, but you can't see what's going on in a wide region. So mostly we're interested in for looking at relations to cognitive development or emotional development. We're interested in change in wider regions because we think mostly it's collections of neurons that are producing behavior, not a single neuron. And so mostly we're using the techniques that are up towards the top where it says wide region, ranging from EEG to MRI and PET. I'm going to talk a little bit about how EEG works and how it relates to evoked potentials. You're reading some things about that in the suggested readings. There are more articles about these if for those of you that want to get a deeper knowledge. There's ongoing electrical activity of the brain. In this graph, you see that at the top. And an evoked potential is a kind of an average from a number of occasions of the ongoing electrical activity to determine how the brain responds to a particular event. With the brain waves moving all around all the time, it's really not possible to see clearly the brain's response to one event from one occurrence of that event because there's so much noise relative to that event in going on in the brain activity. So you have to average. You have to take plot the brain's response over time and average across many trials. Here is an example of graphs going from a response to a single stimulus at the top where you don't see any particular response to the event that occurs down at the bottom marked by the arrow. But as you average more and more, you see the response to that event gradually emerging. This event was given many times. It's usually something like a light flash or a beep for the simplest occasion, simplest stimulus. When you average together 64 of those things, you get a very clean response that you see to the flash of light, for example. When you do it again with the same person, a few days later, you get almost exactly the same curve when you average another 64 responses. So it's quite a stable measure, but it can only come from averaging across many brain waves because the brain is spontaneously active, and so you can't easily see a response to one event from looking at one instance of brain activity. These are all measured now these days through electrode caps, usually. In rare cases, you actually implant electrodes in the cortex, but that's mostly in animals, not in people. It's done occasionally in people for specific medical purposes. Usually for people, you just put this cap on. Each of those little white circles is for an electrode, and then a bunch of wires, you see them running out the back, go off to a computer, which records the processes the brain activity and then records it on some kind of a tape or a CD or something. So you can measure a whole lot of different locations on the cortex, or you can measure just one. You always have to have at least two electrodes, the one in the place you want to measure the activity and a reference electrode, because you're always looking at the difference between the activity where the main electrode is and the reference or a kind of ground electrode. This is a brain from the top, nose at the top of the page there, and the right hemisphere, left hemisphere. These are the standard lobes of the cortex as usually described: frontal, central, temporal, parietal, and occipital. This kind of map is important for the cycles of brain growth that we're going to describe, since one of the things that happens with the cycles of growth is that it seems that growth processes move around the cortex, having their peak change occurring in different places at different times. So there are two main measures we're going to talk about. One is power, or it's also called energy. It's the amount of energy in the wave. So if you think about that squiggly wave that was on the screen, you use a calculus, integral calculus, to measure the area under the wave. And that is the energy in the wave. The best measure for developmental analysis is relative power. It turns out that relative power shows wonderfully clean, interesting developmental curves. Absolute power's curves are much more variable. Absolute power is simply the amount of energy in the wave at a given time. Relative power is the amount of energy in one region divided by the amount of energy in the whole EEG. So you've got the energy for a frequency band in one region. I think I neglected to say frequency band. And that's divided by the total energy for that for all the frequency bands in that region. So if you want to have the relative power in the left occipital area of the cortex, you need to decide what frequency band you're going to focus on. For our purposes, we're going to talk about alpha, which is the kind of band that predominates when we're in a quiet, alert state, especially if our eyes are closed, like when you're meditating. And you take the energy in that frequency band and you divide it by the energy in all of the frequency bands. That gives you the relative energy for alpha in the occipital lobe for the left hemisphere of the cortex. We'll see that the relative power shows growth patterns that are remarkably parallel to the changes we see cognitively in infancy, childhood, and adolescence. Here's a graph of a study from Japan where Mizuno and his colleagues looked at infant EEG, a measure of relative power. Here you'll see there's a series of fits and starts or spurts and drops. The red line is the mean power. The blue lines are the range of power from maximum to minimum. I just marked here the connection to the skill level of sensory motor actions at about 4 months, sensory motor mappings at about 8 months, and systems at about 12 months. The correspondence is really remarkable. If you then look at the classic study of these changes in childhood and adolescence, it was done in Sweden for medical purposes by Matusik and Peterson, published in 1973. They didn't realize it showed these interesting developmental curves. They just published it for medical use. But then Roy, John, and others detected that it had a clear developmental pattern. If you look at relative power in the alpha band in the back of the brain, occipital parietal, you get these wonderful growth curves that show fits and starts. Looks a lot like, if you take one piece of it, it looks a lot like the reflective judgment curve that you saw. There are a series of fits and starts. I'm going to change it into change scores, which are often used in this kind of an analysis because they highlight the peaks and the troughs. When you look at change scores, you can see that there are a series of peaks and troughs or spurts and drops. And again, they correspond remarkably well to the levels of skill development measured by optimal level studies. Moving from single representations on through the levels of representation into the levels of abstractions, ending with abstract systems. We don't have data on further into the 20s to test for the fourth level of abstract development. So we have here patterns of spurts over time, showing a a series of spurts that mark each of the developmental levels, and it turns out that the patterns have another aspect to them, which is that it looks like they move systematically around the cortex. We have to do a lot more research to really pin this down, but the couple of studies that exist suggest a very systematic pattern of movement of the peak power spurts through different cortical regions associated with the different levels in each tier. Here's a graph of it, one of these cycle graphs that we're using to try to illustrate graphically what the nature of the cycle is. Here we have the beginning of a cycle with power growth in the frontal cortex. You'll see a graph in a little bit that shows it, what looks like a power spurt at the beginning of each of the tiers of cognitive development. Then moves over into probably the right hemisphere in the back, occipital parietal growth being stronger. Then the central and temporal, first in the right, then on the left hemisphere. Next to the back on the left, on the left hemisphere. So we're moving from frontal to right hemisphere, over to left hemisphere, and then back. And we think that each of these patterns corresponds to particular skill levels within a tier. And then, of course, it moves on to the next tier. There's a little bit of evidence besides EEG that's supportive of this. One of the most exciting pieces, for example, is evidence that dendritic growth in infancy is stronger in the right hemisphere in the early months and then moves over to become stronger in the left hemisphere. Of course, if you've got more kind of power activity going on in the right hemisphere, you might expect that to go along with more growth of dendrites. And then same for the left. Now, the work by Hudspeth and Prebrum takes the Swedish data, the Matusik and Peterson data, analyzes it more thoroughly, and one of the things that they found was this curve for the increase in energy in the frontal areas. You'll see it has big jumps and drops. And the first big jump is with the emergence of representations in the representational tier at about 2 years of age. That's a huge jump. There's another jump, a little bit more modest, with the emergence of abstractions at about 9 or 10 years. And then there's another huge jump as we move beyond adolescence into adulthood, with the high-level abstract systems and maybe sophisticated principles integrating those abstractions. So the frontal cortex, we think, is central for kind of holding online multiple items in working memory so that we can, in a sense, glue them together. When you're building a new tier, you have a new cognitive unit that's being put together, it makes a lot of sense that the frontal cortex would have a central role in that, gluing the pieces together. And this evidence suggests that may well be true, as it's detected very simply by brain activity. You have more power in the frontal cortex at the points in development when you have one of these new tiers being built. So, in general, we've taken these kinds of evidence and generalized it into a neural network growth hypothesis that with each developmental level, we hypothesize there's a new neural network that spurts forth, and we can detect it through these complicated growth curves in brain activity and in skill growth. The growth processes move around the cortex systematically, so we can also begin to make connections with particular parts of the cortex as we connect behavior to brain activity. In general, the frontal cortex seems to lead in these developments. The general idea is kind of like a tuning idea. It's like you've got a network that's vibrating, kind of like a string on a violin. When you change what it's connected to, or how many turns it has, or other properties of the network, then it changes the way it vibrates. So the EEG patterns change because the network has changed. It's kind of like, I had this on an earlier slide, a lot of this work is kind of like an auto mechanic trying to figure out how the auto is working by looking at the vibrations of the engine and the fluid flow through the engine. These imaging techniques are kind of like that for the brain. We can't actually take the brain apart and put it back together again the way you can with an engine, but we can measure the vibrations and we can measure the fluid flow, and that's what we're doing in this developmental neuroscience work. So the networks involve connections among cortical regions. Here's the diagram of the cortex again. Now we've marked the prefrontal area, which is the place that seems to be so central for working memory and the place this leading role in the formation of networks. Here's an example of connections from frontal to occipital for the two hemispheres. Here's an example of connections from frontal to temporal for the two hemispheres. And of course, there are many other possibilities within hemispheres and between hemispheres. It turns out that the vast majority of the connections that we have evidence for actually growing are within hemisphere. There are only a few between hemisphere ones. And the vast majority of the within hemisphere ones involve connecting the prefrontal to other parts of the cortex. There are only a few like temporal to parietal in the right hemisphere, or parietal to occipital in the left hemisphere. Mostly it's frontal to elsewhere. There's a measure that helps us look at the growth of these connection patterns. It's called coherence. It's a measure of the connections between brain regions. It uses EEG or MEG. In this case, the data we're going to present is EEG again. And it looks at the correlations between the waveforms in different cortical regions. There are clear developmental patterns in the data for those correlations. One of the things that happens, as you'll see, is that there's a shift in the pattern of coherence change at the same ages that you have the growth spurts for power and the growth spurts for skill. So it's looking at this point like there's this very nice coherent picture of networks growing, producing skill changes, producing changes in brain activity, power, and producing changes in connections between cortical regions. This is a perfect coherence, very high coherence, which would be 1.00 or 100% between the front and the back of the brain. If we had very low coherence, it would be like this, where the two waves are very, very different. There's essentially zero correlation between them. So coherence is measured between 0 and 1, or 0 and 100%. When you plot it, Bob Thatcher has done the most work in this area, in a wonderful, detailed study of the development of coherence. You get curves like this. Lots of oscillations. Not just a hierarchical growth as we've seen for power and for skill, but ups and downs that don't go up in the long haul. They just go back down again. those ups and downs show these phase shifts I mentioned. Here there's one at about 7 years of age, which is the emergence of representational systems, or what Piaget called concrete operations. If we look at all of these patterns, as Thatcher has done, and try to figure out how they fit together, it looks like there's a growth cycle in those patterns. The most detailed model of the growth cycles is this one that we put together, Sam Rose and I. starting off with front-to-back connections in both hemispheres. So you have your network starting to grow by having the maximal growth of connection, of coherence, being from front to back in both hemispheres at the same time. Then it shifts over to become more and more local in the right hemisphere. So instead of being both hemispheres, it becomes primarily right, starting global, becoming local, until eventually finishes with the right hemisphere as the peak growth place, moves just into the frontal for a short time, and then moves over to the left hemisphere, where now it starts more local, as you can see in the graph, like temporal, occipital, frontal, temporal, temporal, central, but then becomes gradually more global, more front to back, until it returns to the front to back in both hemispheres and starts the whole thing over again. And once again, it moves into the right hemisphere, becomes gradually more and more local, then into the frontal for both hemispheres, and then into the left hemisphere, moving from local to global, and starting over again. At this point, it looks like a cycle like this occurs for each of the skill levels that we have been talking about. So there would be one of these for the level that emerges at age 4. There would be another one for the level that emerges in optimal functioning at about age 7. Another one at about age 10, and so forth, through all of the 13 levels. This kind of a model allows us to begin to make much more precise correspondences between brain functioning and skill changes. For example, within a level or domain, according to this model, the right hemisphere should normally predominate early in the process of learning or development, should move over into the left hemisphere. Actually, it turns out there's good evidence for that in some aspects of reading and language and music. Within a hemisphere, you can get very specific as well. So, for example, within the right hemisphere, you would expect occipital parietal functions to develop earlier than temporal central functions because of the way the growth cycles occur. And the opposite for the left hemisphere. It looks like we have cycles within cycles here. We have two kinds of growth cycles. We have the growth cycles for connection, and we have the growth cycles for power. And they're nested inside each other. So you have a cycle within a cycle. With a cycle for levels, and then another cycle for tiers, right, including the cycles for levels. I'm going to diagram that all together. Hopefully this diagram will help kind of get across the idea of nesting of levels within tiers. You start off with the power cycle in the frontal area, moves into the right hemisphere. As level one emerges, you have an occurrence of the coherence or connection cycle. Then power moves on to the second level, with more central temporal involvement, and again in parallel with that, there's a cycle of the connection among cortical regions. Then again, you move on to the third level for a tier, focus on occipital parietal functions for power in the left hemisphere, and again in parallel with that, connectivity or coherence cycle. And then the whole thing starts over again as you move on to another tier. So it looks like an exquisitely coordinated kind of dance of power growth and connection growth moving around the cortex systematically in ways that correlate very closely with the kinds of cognitive and emotional changes we see in developmental levels. In general, These kinds of cycles lead us to think much more about brain plasticity, about the fact that the brain has many capacities for change, even well into adulthood and old age. The brain adapts remarkably to different experiences in adults as well as in children. While some basic functions are laid down early and harder to change, most of the things that we care about in education are highly flexible throughout adulthood, as long as we don't have brain damage of some sort. And these growth cycles help explain that plasticity, because we can keep recycling through and doing things that we didn't do last time, as we kind of repeat brain reorganization in one cycle after another after another. Some of the nicest examples of this plasticity come from, they're kind of horrible cases, but they have really nice outcomes in some ways. Cases of children who have had to lose a hemisphere. In some cases, it's a hemispherectomy, as you're reading about in the book Half a Brain is Enough, where a child has epilepsy and has to have a hemisphere removed to stop it. In other cases, it's some other reason that a hemisphere is eliminated. And in this case, we have a young lady named Melissa, who, as you can see in the MRI of her brain over here, has a huge hole in her left hemisphere. Almost all of it's missing. She had a major stroke in utero before she was born, lost her left hemisphere. She was born, she's developed, and she's a young adult who is relatively normal. She is quite talented with language skills, even though she lost her left hemisphere, which is supposed to have more of a function with language. She does have some hemiplegia, which is goes with all of these hemispherectomies. If when you lose a hemisphere, you lose some of the skill, often a lot of it, on the opposite side from the hemisphere. So she lost her left hemisphere, and so on her right side, she looks like she's got cerebral palsy. And all of the children who have hemispherectomies have that. They lose part of their visual field, they lose part of their control of their hands and legs on the opposite side. But for higher cognitive functions, they frequently do very well, going to normal schools, functioning normally, going to college. It's a remarkable example of the plasticity of the brain. And of course, it would it will provide eventually a wonderful test of the cycle hypothesis, because they only have one hemisphere, and a big part of the normal cycle seems to be moving from one hemisphere to another. So it's really going to be fascinating to see how they do it all with just one hemisphere. This is just to illustrate how the hemispheres work. You have the left hemisphere dealing more with the right hand, and the right hemisphere dealing more with the left hand and foot. And then for the eyes, it's actually the visual half of the visual field rather than the eye. So the right hemisphere goes to the left visual field, and the left hemisphere goes to the right visual field. So if you hold your eyes still and divide right in the middle, then this is the right visual field and this is the left visual field for each eye. So when they lose their left hemisphere, they lose their right visual field for each eye. So that's a visual deficit that they never overcome. But they can learn everything they need to learn for school with the side of the visual field that they do have, where they can see quite skillfully. In general, then, we have a very plastic brain, a very plastic set of learning and cognitive capacities, and these grow, both the brain and the skill, grow in recurring cycles. showing stage-like times of discontinuities for optimal levels of skill, but not for ordinary functioning, and showing stage-like cycles of change in power and coherence for brain activity. We don't know what other characteristics of the brain are going to have this kind of close connection. It wouldn't be surprising now that we have good ways of measuring brain anatomy to find that there's some aspects of brain anatomy that show these cycles too, that correlate with the behavioral changes. We'll see in coming years. In general, we think that there are at least two kinds of cycles nested within each other, a cycle for the big changes from reflex to action to representation to abstraction, the tiers, and then within that nested a cycle of levels. So you have a cycle nested within a cycle. Now, as a kind of concluding thing to think about, there's a possibility that this fractal quality, as they call it in dynamic systems, where a higher level structure and a lower level structure look the same, it's possible that there's another kind of a cycle, not just a cycle for the big changes of tiers and the cycle for the small changes of levels, but another kind of cycle for the ordinary changes of learning that we do every day over a few minutes or hours or days. So we have cycles nested within cycles, and maybe those again nested within cycles. So development occurs in cycles. That's a basic idea, an idea that has not been very well formulated until recently, which is now one of the most exciting ideas in the study of cognitive and brain development.